On the line, I have Cormac Moore, a historian in residence, and we're going to talk about the transition and the changeover from British to Irish in 1922. Good afternoon, Cormac. How are you?
Good afternoon, all. Very good, thanks.
Okay.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. And, well, how did it go? How did it go? Was it smooth or the handover?
My Christmas or the actual...
Both, yeah. How did your Christmas go in the new year?
No, it was fine. It was good. Quiet because of Omicron.
Yeah, of course.
But wasn't say it was a damp squib, but it was it wasn't that much that happened really. In terms of there wasn't a huge big ceremony. There wasn't a it wasn't a huge event, I suppose, at the time. But it was obviously incredibly important, particularly on the 16th of January, when you had the handover from Dublin Castle. And Dublin Castle wasn't just a building or the headquarters of British rule; it is also a symbol of British rule for centuries. And when people often refer to Dublin Castle, they weren't just talking about the actual building itself, but about British government governing in Ireland, full stop. So it was a very symbolic moment when the Provisional Government of the Irish Free State took over, essentially, the duties of what the Dublin Castle had done before.
Yeah, and the ceremony didn't happen in Dublin Castle either, did it?
Oh, it did, yeah. No, the actual...
Okay.
But there was... When you talk about, say, British soldiers or the auxiliaries or RIC, there was often more kind of military ceremonies when they were leaving barracks around the country and so on. And installations and other places, but there wasn't, like, what happened on the 16th of January was that the Provisional Government, which was chaired by Michael Collins, met in the morning. They arrived at Dublin Castle around 1:30 in the afternoon. They stayed there for about an hour. They were met by the Lord Lieutenant, or the last Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, Lord Fitzalan, who happened to be a Catholic, the first Catholic Lord Lieutenant since the 17th century, and he met them, wished them success, and essentially then they all met with the various different kind of heads of departments from the local government, finance, so on, from different government departments of Dublin Castle, which was a bit strange because some of the ministers of the Provisional Government were ministers of the Dáil Government, the illegal Dáil Government, mm-hmm. and so they were actually meeting their counterparts. One considered illegal and one the British kind of ministers. That was a bit bizarre. So they met him for about an hour and that was it. And then he went back to the Mansion House. When Collins arrived back to the Mansion House, he saw Griffith and said, Griffith, the castle had fallen.
Yes.
So there was a bit of jubilation afterwards, and there was the press used the word surrender quite a bit, and even the Provisional Government used the word surrender quite a bit as well. So, it was used for PR purposes and propaganda purposes. But you have to remember, this was obviously a significant moment for those who supported the treaty, and it was used by them to show, look, this is what we've achieved. You know, we've actually removed the British from most of Ireland, and here's a very clear, very quick example of that.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think that maybe it should have, it went a bit too smoothly, did it?
Well, no. It wasn't much of a huge event, and the British didn't just leave on the 16th of January. You know, it was a very gradual process, which happened over months. Like the Lord Lieutenant, the various different civil servants that had been in place in Dublin Castle, they remained for most of 1922 until it was a provisional government from January 1922 until December the 6th, 1922. That's when officially the Irish Free State came into being.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of transition still to be done. So I don't think that, it went more or less smoothly than it should have gone. It was obviously an important juncture removing British authority for as we must admit, most of Ireland, because obviously the six counties of Northern Ireland was a different jurisdiction.
Yeah, I suppose what it was more or less within our own government that things were happening rather than with the British at that time, once the handover was done.
Exactly.
That's when all the trouble was between ourselves. We started fighting among ourselves.
Yeah, it was a bit, and there was a bit of a vacuum as well of governance. So with the British leaving, there was this kind of limbo, and then you had two governments from, say, the pro-treaty side. You had the Dáil government, which was led by Arthur Griffith, after the vote in the Dáil on the 7th of January, when the anti-treaty side lost by 57 to 64 votes. De Valera asked for an election, for him to be elected or not as president. He lost that vote by 2, and then he left the Dáil. So Arthur Griffith became president. So then you had the Dáil government, and then you had a transitional government, a provisional government, which was led by Collins. And you also still had many and figures from the British government still there on Dublin Castle. And as we well know, that the many people, whether De Valera, but particularly the IRA, was split, and they didn't recognise any of those governments. So there was this big vacuum happening in the first half of 1922, unfortunately it led to civil war in the summer of that year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just trying to think about what way it would have worked if things hadn't been interrupted by the civil war, as regards even at the beginning of it, financially. If you forget about the politics of it, about the finances, did the British government support financially things in the transition?
So did the British government give the Irish support?
Yeah, like any financial support.
But they did financially, in terms of military anyway, they gave them weapons and a lot of support that way, because they wanted the treaty to work as well, so they provide a lot of the weaponry and ammunition for the Irish Free State, which obviously would have cost a lot if it wasn't provided for the British. So there was, but obviously under the treaty terms, the Irish were to pay part of the debt of the wars, the conflicts of recent years. They weren't getting anything for free, really, and they would have had to pay substantial amounts of money to the British. Now there was an agreement reached in 1925 that if they left the North as the status quo, they would not have to pay a lot of that debt. So they washed their hands of the nationals in the North and didn't have to pay substantial debt to the British for the very different wars. The British wanted this to work because it was in the interest of the British government for the treaty to succeed. There was a lot riding on the British politically for the treaty. So they were adamant that it would succeed, and they were in many ways they pushed for military action to be taken against the anti-treatyites, and particularly after Field Marshal Henry Wilson was killed. That nothing was done with the people who overtook the four courts in April of that year.
Okay, anything else significant that we should know, Cormac?
Well, there's a lot of events coming up now. Like 22 is obviously a very important year in Irish history. Obviously the most important part is the Civil War. So there's a lot going to be happening kind of in the next number of months, kind of leading to that very tragic moment in Irish history. The fallout from the army is obviously very important. The conflict in the North, there was actually two civil wars happened in Ireland pretty much in 1922, not just the one in the South, but the vicious violence in the North was way worse than any other period and during those years of conflict.
That's something that's not talked about too much, isn't it? It's not. I don't know if it's as well known as our own conflict down here. Is it as well known about the civil war up the north?
No, it's never usually called a civil war, but it should be, in my opinion, because hundreds were killed, most of them civilians, and the worst of the violence was certainly the first half of 1922. But yeah, unfortunately, there is this kind of partition within Irish history as well. In that a lot of people who either write or teach history tend to focus on the South as much and ignore the North, even though they were both intertwined and they both related to each other. But yeah, no, it's not. You're right. It's not well known that what happened in the north in the centre.
Okay. Has any books been written? I mean, there's loads of books being written on lots of things about what was happening around that time. Is that specific about what was happening up north as well?
Oh yeah, there's plenty of books. I covered it in quite detail myself in my book, First the Border, but there's a lot of books very specifically related to the kind of the military aspects of the north. You know, we've got people like Alan Parkinson and Kieran Glennon and Robert Lynch, who've written extensively on the violence that engulfed the north from 1920 to 1922.
Okay, we talk about your book, Cormac. Where is that available?
It's available in most shops, I would imagine, still, and it's online, definitely in most online platforms. You can still get it.
And get it in the library as well?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It should be in most libraries too.
Okay, any talks coming up from yourself? Now, I know it'll probably have to be Zoom talks and virtual sort of things, but any coming up?
Yeah, no, I've known the schedule at the moment, but I will be doing, last 2 years, I did very successful series of a 6-part series on Ireland in 1920, Ireland 1921. So I will be doing an Ireland in 1922 from March, I'd imagine. That'll start. So it'll be a 6-week course. But I'll confirm the details in due course.
Okay, and we look forward to that, Cormac. It's great talking to you today, as always. Always great interest from our listeners on the history. Thank you very much, and look forward to talking to you again, Cormac.
Thanks, Noel.